And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and I'm glad to welcome Eric Barnes back to the program today. Eric is a publisher of several newspapers in Tennessee and a writer of fiction. He's appeared on Book Talk to talk about his previous novels, Shimmer and Something Pretty, Something Beautiful. Today we'll be talking about his newest book, The City Where We Once Lived, which is available from Arcade Publishing. Now, Eric, the narrator of the book is unnamed, and he doesn't give people names in the story either. He just refers to them by their professions or their genders or their age. Why did you want to have this be an unnamed group of people?
There's a kind of quick and flippant answer, and then there's the longer answer. The quick and flippant one is I hate coming up with names, and I hate doing physical description as a writer. It's just something that other parts of writing are very simple for me and enjoyable for me or whatever, but those parts I struggle with. So I generally write without names. And I generally write without a lot of physical description.
Do you see the people in your head? Or do you only feel their personas?
See, I think that's exactly it. And I can remember even back, 20-something years ago being in writing workshops in college and graduate school and people saying, well, I can't see these people. So it was always something that didn't come naturally to me. And I've always sort of written with holes and then I come back and fill in that. And this one, I'd gotten far enough along and there's this kind of, it began to make sense as I wrote more and more of the book. And the kind of tone of the book and the city where they live, that let's see if I can pull it off. Let's see if they can be unnamed. And let's see if I can give enough character that people can fill in the blanks themselves, fill in the blanks of who they might be, see themselves in the characters, see friends, see family, see someone in them. Originally, I kind of wanted to write a book about a city and have no characters. I knew that wasn't realistic for a novel, but I like cities and I like the whole notion of how cities, the kind of rhythm they have and their own sort of, they're their own organism. And towns are too, and all communities are, but I just particularly like cities. So I wrote lots and lots about the city itself, but I knew I had to put characters in them. But I kind of like the idea that there are a lot of buildings and districts in the there's the industrial district, there's the downtown, there's the historic neighborhood, then there's the library and there's the museum. And so it made sense to then say, well, then there's the newspaper editor and there's the gardener. And they all have a role in the same way that the buildings and the neighborhoods and the areas of the city have a role, the highway. It was, as usual for me, less planned out, but it kind of made sense. And I think I was able to pull it off. Someone who read the book recently told me that they were on page 200 before they realized that characters weren't named. And I thought that was incredibly satisfying for me.
Well, and I think in your previous novel, geography and architecture seemed to play a very big role. And the way your characters were navigating the spaces and everything seemed very important in that, too.
Yes. Yeah. And Something Pretty, Something Beautiful. I mean, the city, Tacoma, I mean, it's a named city and all the characters are named, but Tacoma has these places that are very much almost, I mean, the gulch where they go and do really terrible things is its own character almost and brings out in them, the boys in that book.
And just the way they made their way through the houses when they were burgling the houses.
Yeah. God, that's funny. I hadn't really thought about that, but that way of wandering through the houses they've broken into, and for people who haven't read the book, they don't steal anything. They just like to go in for the adventure. It's risky. Some of them, they just kind of like the quiet. And that is like the way the narrator at various times kind of wanders through the city in this new book. I think I do sort of like that notion of quiet spaces, walking. I mean, there's a lot of quiet in Shimmer, my first novel. I mean,
it's one person essentially for most of the book.
Yeah. I mean, in that building, you talk about spaces. I wrote 220 pages. I mean, I was 150, almost 200 pages in before I realized he'd never left the building. And then that becomes a part of his story. But he wanders from floor to floor and different floors have different, character and different characters in them. And then he has a lot of quiet time alone in his office and in his apartment at night and those sort of quiet, contemplative or badly contemplative, spaces for people. So I guess I hadn't totally made those connections.
So the city came to you first before the narrator.
Yeah. In some way, I've always been just really interested in and loved photography of – this is strange, but it's photography of kind of environmental wastelands. And I have
lots of famous French photographers that took the pictures of Detroit.
Yes. Yeah. But even before I did cities, I remember it was a photo essay in Rolling Stone. It must have been the early 90s. It was after the Berlin Wall fell and Western photographers and journalists could get in there. And there's this photo essay of it was probably Budapest. And it was beautiful, but it was raining ash. And the city was filthy. And they wrote about it in this photo essay that went with it. It was beautiful in all its kind of awfulness because, you know, the communists had no pollution controls and no environmental controls and everything was, it was just awful. And from there, I've always kind of picked up books of kind of not landscapes, but of scenes like that, and then into cities and then into Detroit books and some of the books of William Eggleston. Before I think even moved to Memphis, I was a fan of William Eggleston in part for that, although he does a lot of characters too. And yeah, I would look at those books. I would often look at those books just to kind of almost like before I would write. There's a book, Earth from Above, that's kind of a coffee table style book, but it's very beautiful and has all these scenes of India and of environmental waste, environmental beautiful things. And I would actually kind of sit and it would calm me down and then I would work on whatever book I was working on long before I wrote City Where I Once Lived. And so when I was getting ready to write a new book, I think I was looking through one of those books just as my part of my ritual of writing. And I thought, well, what about writing a book about one of these cities, about one of these places, this photography you like so much? And then I also had in my mind William Eggleston, like who are those people in his photos, you know, and who might they be in a place in a city? And that's where I ended up with this notion of an empty city. It was not meant to be Detroit, although that's the obvious, you know, kind of the most obvious example.
And it's got the canals. And
yeah, yeah. But I also thought a lot about Katrina and New Orleans. You know,
the overpass scene definitely resonates with that.
Yeah. Fundamentally, what happens to if a city, and virtually all American cities have gone through this, New York in the 70s, Memphis in the 70s, a lot of southern cities in the 70s, a lot of northeastern cities in the 70s, almost didn't come back. You know, I mean, New York almost, it's hard to believe now when you go there, but New York almost went bankrupt in the 70s. It was filthy. It was mismanaged. It was a place people didn't want to be. What happened if it just kept going? And so what's important about the book for me is not that it's an apocalypse or a plague. It's that it was human beings choosing to let a city go and that the world goes on around that city. That was, for me, interesting. Also, when I thought about books and distinguishing it from other books in terms of marketability and all those kinds of things you end up having to think about, you know, The Road by Cormac McCarthy to me is the ultimate American dystopia, apocalyptic, post-apocalyptic. It's been done. I don't need to go there and try to do that. I mean, that's my personal opinion, you know. I mean, and I'm not insulting the other books that have done that since him, but this to me was kind of a way to distinguish from other dystopian or apocalyptic, post-apocalyptic fiction.
Because as empty and barren as it's a metropolitan area, the north side of town has emptied out except for a couple of thousand stragglers. And the south side is going still a lot of trouble and chaos in its own way. But we're very in the very early days of a worldwide eschatology, essentially.
Right, right.
But that north side is a brownfield, essentially. Yep. People in Memphis, kind of like the Firestone area, has kind of emptied out. Nothing mm-hmm. can grow there.
Yes. Yeah. And he wanders through and he writes about them because the newspaper still operates and the narrator, and he takes pictures and he does research in the library and he has a real fixation on an interest in those places. And again, that goes back to some of those books of photography in my mind, that there's a kind of strange beauty to it. I mean, I think, you know, the book is dark and the city is sort of desolate, but it's also, I think, at times really beautiful. You know, there's scenes where he's looking at the architecture of abandoned buildings and it's just so ornate and how much effort went into them and how beautiful they still are even in their abandonment. And in the city, you know, the power's still on and so the lights will go on and off at random intervals. And I wrote so much of that in the kind of first pass without really focusing on the characters. And back to, I sort of wanted to write this, you know, some part of me would have loved to write just this vision, you know, this photograph, a written photograph of this city. And then a study of the machinations of how a city would work if there were only 1,000 people left. I mean, I wanted to, but I also knew I had to put characters and a plot in there. But there's this part of me that didn't want to do that at all. And that's kind of how he lives. I mean, there's too much of me in him. He sort of lives or tries to live without a plot. He's just kind of haunted by everything. But he tries to live just day to day, walking the city and taking pictures and not attaching to anyone.
And he still uses old photographic technology with film that has to be developed. And the technology of the time seems to be locked in the early 70s. Right. The contemporary technology has not remained in the area.
Yeah. There are allusions to the time period. I mean, it's more recent than it might seem. There's a scene where some people come in from the north end, from the real world, and they have a cell phone that doesn't work and they have radios and so on. And you know, there are moments where the narrator, references walking by houses that are occupied by some of those few people who still live there. And he'll see the blue-white light of a television. And he could have a television and live in the city. He could have a cell phone, probably, you know, technically he's up in a high building, so maybe he could get – that's not in the book, but it's somewhat implicit that – it's not just the city's been abandoned, it's his choice of how he lives there. And I think that's true of the other characters, their choices of how they live there.
And he chooses to live in an abandoned hotel instead of a single family home in a neighborhood perhaps closer to other people. So it's not only is he isolating himself by not being in a neighborhood, but then to surround himself with all those empty rooms is a further insulation of loneliness around him.
Right, right. And I like the idea of him walking up those flights of stairs. And I like the idea. I mean, and then personally, I just really like hotels. I have kind of a hotel fixation. I like old hotels. Oddly enough, I recently moved to Crosstown Concourse, which is an old renovated building in Memphis. And I was staring out my window and I thought, "Ooh, this is getting creepy." This is long after I had finished the book and, you know, published the book recently. But so again, there's a little too much of him in me, or me in him.
Well, are you a pyromaniac as well?
I think I was as a kid. Yeah, and that obviously happens in the second book in Something Pretty. There's a lot of fires and the boys do a lot of burning things down. And in this one, yeah, I was definitely focused on that sort of power of, and the sort of fire and of destroying things, and fire is a metaphor and all that kind of stuff.
What does he set fire to in the North Side?
He sets fire to houses. He will light houses on fire and watch them burn. Houses that have been abandoned. He's not destroying anybody's property per se, and he's certainly not intending to hurt anyone. There's a point where he distracts some bad kids with fire, which was kind of fun for me to do in a number of ways. And then obviously then there's a history. I don't know how far we go into that, but there's as the book progresses, you realize there's a history of why he's burning those houses down and a terrible thing that had happened in his past.
Now, it seems that the four classical Greek elements all are a danger in this place. You have the earth, which is polluted and poisoned. You have fire, him being the pyromaniac. You have air, being the tornadoes that come from time to time. And you have water, which a flood and the canals play a big role.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about it that way, but I certainly was thinking about those really elemental issues. So that's interesting that I'd hit them all. I mean, it's a place where it perpetually rains, kind of a mist, you know, just constantly a little bit of rain. And there are canals. The city has been built on essentially on a tidal plain it's recovered, you know, land, a lot like New Orleans or, you know, what, the Netherlands, that kind of thing. And the canals, because the city's been abandoned, are slowly breaking. And so the water from a bay far to the north is encroaching on the city itself and destroying it, you know, and the storms that are coming. So, yeah, I liked all that. I like that sort of sense of the real barrenness of it, you know, and the real kind of elemental existence.
You have to wonder, why do people stay in this place? And for some, it's solitude, and for others, it's penance.
Yes. There's the narrator, but then he, you know, there's probably give or take six of them that are relatively main characters, people he begins to meet. There's a minister and there's a woman with her son who are fleeing something, and the gardener I mentioned, and who's kind of more about a kind of rebirth and beginning to plant in this place that otherwise you could not plant in, where nothing seems to grow. Yeah, they all have their stories, and that to me was interesting. And then, you know, more people are there, and you meet some people incidentally, like the if I'm allowed to say, you know, one of my favorite things I wrote in the book was the security guard at the airport, who has basically half a page of presence. He is not a main character, but he talks about how he quotes from an interview he did with this security guard who continues to walk around the airport, even though the airport hasn't been used in decades and, you know, the city's been abandoned for quite some time. But he just has decided he's always been there. He's always lived there. He's always done this. And so he's going to always keep doing it. I think there are so many reasons people live in a city, in a regular modern city, in a fully functioning city, and make those choices. So I think that's what I was after, is exploring that in depth or even in the kind of incidental ways.
So you had mentioned Cormac McCarthy's The Road before, and Emily St. John Mandel has a large blurb on the front cover, and she has an airport plays a big role in Station 11. So how do you explore this eschatology, the end of times, and put your own spin on it?
Right.
Because you empty places out and some themes have to reoccur.
Yeah. And I will say, you know, so I had read The Road, you know, not long after it came out, however many years ago that was, and it was just a profound experience. It was upsetting. It was beautiful. It was just, it's just one of the most impactful books. I mean, his book Blood Meridian is another one that was just incredibly impactful. Emily and I have known each other, are friends, not close friends, friends. Our first books were published by Unbridled Books together. So that's where I met her. Last Night in Montreal was her first book, and mine was Shimmer. And we did a couple of events together and remained sort of Facebook friends. And she was really nice to review my second book for online. And then I was getting, like I said, I was thinking about what I'm going to write next. And I start in 2012, and I write and finish City Where We Once Lived. And I was talking to a writer friend of mine, and I said something about Emily. And he goes, "You know Emily?" And I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "You know, she was shortlisted for the National Book Award." And I go, "Really?" And mostly because I'm jealous. I mean, not of her. I don't, you know, but I hadn't been paying attention. Yeah, I'd been in a little low, or I hadn't been published. I didn't know about Station 11. I knew she'd published a book. I think that was probably her fourth book. But I hadn't read it, and I didn't know what it was about. And he said, "Well, you need to get her to blurb your book, because I'm about to get an agent. I'm about to start sending out City, the manuscript." And for people who don't know, I mean, it's a big deal if you can get writers to endorse your book prior to you sending it to an agent, and then the agent. It's just every little bit helps, because it's hard to publish a book. So I emailed Emily and I said, "You know, any chance you have time to read and blurb my book? I understand if you can't." And ironically, it's an apocalyptic sort of book. And by that time, I'd read Station 11 and told her I liked it. But it was completely coincidental that we had done that, you know. And she was, she's the nicest human being. I mean, she got back to me in a day and wrote a blurb in 2 weeks and apologized it took that long. And she, given everything she's done, you could think, you know, it's somebody who's going to be removed from, she is just the most gracious and nicest person.
Unlike Cormac McCarthy's vision of the end of times, there is very little violence on the North Side. Mm-hmm. And it only comes from the outside, it seems.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I wanted to do that just to explore it. There was definitely, as I put more plot into it, you know, there was a desire to explore, to not do zombies, to not do a de-evolution, to instead, it's not a utopia by any stretch, but it's just a kind of quiet place where people live on their own. And it's actually a very inexpensive place to live. And because there are only about 1,000 people and there are not a lot of resources in the vision I have of it, this city is just, it's kind of an abandoned neighborhood, but there are no drugs. No one has the energy for that kind of thing. And it is people and kids initially who come over in cars and just want to cause trouble, want to drive fast, want to drag race. You know, they try to steal the narrator's camera at one point, not because they want the camera, but they're just clearly just trying to cause trouble. You know, for me, because I don't really plot things out, I don't outline things out. It's a process of, well, okay, I have this character, the narrator. How does he respond to violence? And I write my way through that. How does the gardener respond to violence? How does the minister?
And that's a phrase that pops up several times. The second half of the book is capacity for violence.
Capacity for violence, yeah. And there's this group of scavengers, which, you know, I mean, lots of people have scavengers in books of apocalypse. But scavenging, I remember reading Scavenging in Station 11. I was like, oh my, in the airport. And I was like, oh my God, everyone's going to think I'm copying Emily. But the scavengers, too, are this kind of peaceful people, but everyone has a breaking point, or I don't know if everyone does, but in various ways, people in the book have breaking points, and to protect themselves or their family or their friends or the city. And the city begins to take on an identity and a kind of pride, you know, for lack of a better word. And that to me is also interesting, the way people have pride in their neighborhoods or their towns or their, you know, metropolis.
And it almost seems like the end of the world in this area is a metaphor for grief. In the way, and that the pollution is things that we have done to ourselves, and
yeah,
the tornadoes are things that come that are done to us from the world, and it causes these people to retreat into themselves.
Yeah. I liked also the idea that it was a slow unraveling in the city. It was not a bomb going off, like I guess what is implied in the opening of The Road, for instance, or, you know, in The Stand, like Stephen King's book, which I read when I was a teenager, and I loved that book. Which is a big, you know, post-apocalyptic, there's a plague, and it's all about these characters. I wanted it to be the slow evolution or de-evolution of a place, of human choices. And there's, you know, he walks back through in writing these articles and these historical articles about factories and choices that were made and neighborhoods and choices that were made and city councils and mayors and all these choices. Because that's what it really is. You know, it's not the bomb going off. It's a series of long-term choices building on themselves that cause places, be they towns, cities, or neighborhoods, to fail. And then it's choices, long, complicated series of choices that cause cities or towns or neighborhoods to come back.
Now, you mentioned earlier that he takes pictures and writes for the newspaper of the North End.
Yeah.
So how does a concern like that keep going in a depopulated area?
Yeah, I mean, you know, some of that is you know, I worked for run newspapers for, you know, going on, I mean, 15, 20 years of my life, and been in publishing as a, my day job, as I like to say, for 25 years. So I knew newspapers. I liked the idea that I'm familiar with it. So, you know, you want to write what you know, but I liked the idea that it was a way to document the city itself through the newspaper. I liked the idea that to put out a couple hundred papers, which is all it is, and it's only about, I think it's about 8 pages the way he does it once a week, is not terribly expensive and it's not terribly difficult. And it's technology that's decades and decades old and it still works. There's clearly somebody behind. There's a little bit of money that flows through the newspaper that buys the paper and the film and the plates and pays him a little bit of money. It's never made clear where that money comes from, although it goes away at the end and there's kind of a, without giving the whole thing away, it's not a big deal, but there's a perpetuation of the newspaper, which I wanted. So someone somewhere thinks it's important enough to have a newspaper. And that is, you know, true of me. I mean, that it is extremely important that the world has newspapers and valid, real news. And the, his approach to the newspaper in, early on is he writes a lot of these kind of histories, but he begins through the course of the book, as things change, he begins to advocate and he begins, as they say, to write differently and to cover the changes in the city and the people who are sort of rising up, as it were, to say, we want to preserve what we have and make it better. It's important that the press is there to talk about that and write about it. And I've been in newspapers, as we've seen this huge decline in newspapers, decline in staff, but also we're at a time when, you know, nationally newspapers have, are doing some of the most amazing work they've, that has ever been done in terms of the Washington Post and New York Times and other outlets covering the administration. So I think all that, I mean, that, again, I started the book in 2012, so it's not tied to those things, but it is tied to this decline of newspapers we've seen over the last few years.
So do you think that eschatology could be just grafted onto the newspaper world itself, and you have what the newspapers have done to themselves and what has been done to them from the outside?
Yeah, yeah, that would be more of a, I would get on a rant. You're going to goad me into it about the horrific choices that newspapers made when the internet came along. Some consultant out of Silicon Valley made a ton of money walking around saying information must be free and convincing newspapers that, which had been very viable businesses for decades, if not centuries, to take and give away their content. And content that, you know, my joke is that when I lived in New York 25 years ago, I would spend about $300 a year and I had student loans and not a great job, but I would buy the New York Times virtually every day on the street corner. And it worked out to be about $300. Then at some point, the New York Times, I'm in Memphis and the New York Times makes itself free. And I'd rather read it in print, but it's right there and it's free. And I just start reading it. And then some years ago, in the last couple of years, they put a paywall up. I'm a New York Times addict. I immediately sign up and my cost is about $300 a year. And it's just, it's crazy. And so there was a, what, 15-year period, 20-something year period where they gave me all that content for free for no reason. And that was self-inflicted. And so I think you're right that there is, I hadn't thought about it, but there's this, you know, again, I go on my rant, this parallel to the choices people make that bring themselves down.
So would Craigslist be the tornadoes?
Craigslist the tornadoes and, you know, Facebook and all kinds of one-off other sorts of news outlets.
So. Yeah, well, Facebook are the snotty kids that come looking for trouble.
Yeah, right. That's great. Yeah, I like that. Yeah, I'm trying not to be ugly and name names of other news outlets.
The narrator, in putting out the newspaper, that's essentially the way he communicates with the world because his interpersonal skills have atrophied to almost nil.
Yeah. He goes sometimes weeks without talking, but he loses track of his voice and what he sounds like. He struggles to talk. He's very, you know, he is, it becomes clear through the book, there's a history and there's an incident that was, you know, very scarring for him and very wounding. And that's his story of why he's chosen to be there. You know, I had to find a way to write where it didn't get too claustrophobic because he's such a limited person in terms of his ability to speak and talk and interact with others. So some of these other characters, I mean, just for me, because again, I just write my way into things. I would write my way into him thinking about the city, wandering around the city. And I would think, this is getting a little claustrophobic. I got to bring somebody in, you know? So then he comes across this woman and or boy, and then he meets a gardener and then he meets this minister and you get a little more their perspective and voice, and that's important, you know. You know, it's funny you talk about how he communicates because for the first time I've ever done, I wrote a related book. So once this was sold about a year and a half ago, I just had that voice in my head and I liked the city. And so I wrote what essentially is a prequel to it. So it's really basically the world outside the city. And it's coming out with the same publisher next year, which is fantastic for me. But there is a part there where some characters run into this narrator. what would he be like to interact with? And he takes their picture. So again, he's just an incidental character. They don't know anything about him. They just walk by him. But if you'd read this book, you'd pretty clearly see that it's him. And it was fun. It was interesting to write about what does he look like to other people. And he looks kind of, you know, he looks bad. Something's a little off. He's very slow to respond and he's very distracted and he's very peculiar. That it's not just the tone of the book is dark, but it's also his particular view of the world isn't necessarily everyone else's view. And I think in this book, in City, that I hope becomes clear.
In writing another book kind of in this universe,
yeah,
is there a bigger emphasis on characters in that one since you've kind of already established the world, or are you still just examining the world more?
It is partly establishing the world more outside the city and what's going on. Because again, this is not a worldwide thing where every city's been abandoned. I mean, right down the street from this city, there are people living in a million people in a metropolis and so on, a suburban kind of metropolis. There are six characters, so it rotates through them. So one is escaping a flood in the Delta, one in a Delta, one, you know, one is an investor and kind of a hedge fund person in New York. The other is a woman and her husband who live in kind of what would seem to be the California hillsides where these beautiful homes are burning and flooding and landsliding and so on. And there's six of them kind of coming together and eventually all coming towards the city. But there's a scene in City Where We Once Lived towards the end where the narrator runs into some people who fled other places and they talk about how, you know, as much as everything is dead here, in other places it's overgrown. So it's like all the animals that left this city went somewhere. And the narrator sits and has this realization that this something else is going on beyond this city. That's what I wrote about. It's basically those people who in other parts of the world, they're either seeing maybe some atrophy or they're seeing like an explosion of overgrowth. It was fun to write. It made it a little easier because I had the voice. It's not the narrator, but still it's sort of that voice and tone. And I had this idea somewhere in the back of my mind as I was writing this, what would the rest of the world look like? And so I got to put all that on the page in a kind of flurry of work last year, basically.
Beyond finding out what is driving the narrator in his quest for solitude, the big question I had was, why did the South let the electricity and water keep flowing to the North?
There's reference to it, although not necessarily in great detail, but that they are required to.
I remember the meetings, council meetings were required. I didn't know
And it's an it's a kind of a side note, which was intentional that you could not easily miss, but you might miss that. They do it only because they're required to. So there's kind of essentially a county commission. So if you think of cities are within counties, and if a city dissolves, the responsibility for that area rolls up to the county. The county in this case would like to just have nothing to do with this abandoned city. They fear it. They dislike it. They abhor it. They feel that they made their own choices. They feel that it's a dangerous, dark, and scary place. But they are required through, I think the reference is to a lawsuit, that they must keep funding, you know. But there's definitely a sense that they would do anything they could to cut it off, you know. And there's a couple points, I think, where the power does turn off. It turns out to just be kind of a blackout or a little glitch. But the hostility, as you get more and more into the South, the hostility and fear was kind of interesting to write about because it's the way in which all cities have areas that they fear and they misunderstand and that they vilify and that they say we'd be great if not for X. In most cases, those are inner city type areas that have been, you know, segregated and cut off by the same people who now abhor them.
Well, Eric, I want to thank you so much for stopping by and talking with us on Book Talk.
Absolutely. As always, I appreciate your time and appreciate the interview.
Eric Barnes is the author of the novel The City Where We Once Lived, published by Arcade. I'm Stephen Usry, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is produced in the studios of FM 89.3 WYPL Memphis, a service of the Memphis Public Library, a division of the City of Memphis. Book Talk is copyrighted by the Memphis Public Library, all rights reserved.